For the vast majority of the Manx population, wars can be viewed from a distance, and that has been the case for decades. But in 1914 and 1940, Manx people suddenly became involved. They understood what it was to crouch for cover and hear possible death coming towards them, or face appalling mutilation as they fought on battlefields across the world, to see people they knew and were friends with die feet away from them. Today, when we remember in particular the sacrifice of those people, we'll visit again the battle perceived to be the turning point in World War II. It was fought in the desert not far from Cairo, its name El Alamein. The Manx regiment were there, with their CO, Colonel Henry Kelly.
Battle opened with this tremendous barrage that lasted for quite a long time. I'd never seen anything like it. The noise was overwhelming and the whole sky was lit up like a very busy Guy Fawkes night.
These were the British guns?
These were the British guns opening up to soften the German position behind the minefields.
What exactly did you have to do as the commander of your particular
battery?
Yes.
The other two batteries of the Manx Regiment, the territorial batteries, 41 and 42, were protecting our 25-pounder batteries down below the slight escarpment. During the night of the 23rd, after the barrage, the sappers had cleared two routes through the first minefield, which was called January. There was an escarpment leading up to it, so it was difficult, really, to with soft sand, to get through.
You had to get guns through, in fact.
And at 5 o'clock in the morning, when they'd secured cleared the two minefields, I was ordered to get two troops of my battery up through the minefields, through the first minefield, to protect each of the two bridgeheads which the division had opened up.
How successful were you?
Well, the division had were quite successful getting through the first minefield, but after nearly 3 days slogging, they never got through February. So far as the battery was concerned, the first morning of the battle, we managed to knock down one German Messerschmitt. Unfortunately, there were two hills just to the south of us, which the Free French, who were attached to the 7th Armoured, had been told to capture at first light. They had captured it, but with soft going before they could get up their anti-tank guns, the Germans had counterattacked, and they secured the two hills again. And for the rest of that day, we were getting shelled by the German guns on top of these two hills called Hermimat.
Did you have casualties?
Yes. Before 12 o'clock, I'd lost one man, killed, and 10 wounded. Having got up the escarpment, we had to be up there by 7:30. The ground was very hard, and they weren't able to dig in, so that the gun was on top of the ground. They managed to scrape a little bit of a hole round, but they hadn't any real protection. Mm. And of course, they were being shelled most of that day. Mm. And as a result, at the end of the day, I got in touch with the CRA, that's the commander, Royal Artillery, for the whole division, and he said that he understood the position, and he said, you get your troops back for, after dark, and get your other two troops up in the morning. He said they deserve to be relieved.
How long did this battle last?
12 days. 12 days. The Germans retreated. We were after them. But unfortunately, 2 days after, about 14 days after the battle started, there was a tremendous downpour of rain, and everyone was bogged down and there was no movement. And during that time, we were in the open desert. The Germans were nearer the coast road. They got onto the coast road, and a lot of them were able to retreat westwards. Mm.
What was it actually like to be under shell fire? Can you describe the experience?
Well, you, of course, as most soldiers, or temporary soldiers, have felt, you thought nothing would happen to you, I suppose. Otherwise, one wouldn't have been able to soldier on. Mm. And I must confess that that was something that worried me on the ship going out to Egypt. Colonel McClellan was a magnificent commander. He formed the Manx Regiment. He was then retired. He had a very distinguished record, a gallant record, dating from the Boer War. And I said to him, what would happen if I suddenly felt that I couldn't quite manage to stand firm under heavy shell fire? Well, he said, the first thing is, if you hear a shell coming towards you, he said, you needn't worry. There's no point in ducking, because by the time you hear it, it's already past you. And he said, so you just stand where you are. And he said, in the morning, if you duck for the first shell you hear screaming towards you, he said, you'll be ducking all day. And he said, you'll be worn out after an hour or two. So he said, you just stand, because he said, the shell may be aimed at your head or it may be aimed at your feet. You just take your chance. If it's aimed at your feet and you're lying flat on the ground, it'll get you. And the other thing he said, it'll be your duty as a battery commander to go around your guns during action and give them moral support. And if you under shell fire, you start running from one gun to another, you'll get out of breath and you might start panicking. So the only thing to do is just to walk slowly from one gun to the other, because it might be in front of you and might be behind you.
After the battle is over, what sort of feelings do you have then? What sort of feelings do the men have then?
I think those that survived the battle always had a tremendous feeling of exhilaration. It seemed to brace the spirit, and also an intense feeling of comradeship. Mm. Which held the whole regiment together.
Mm. El Alamein and Colonel Henry Kelly of the Manx Regiment. When the troops came ashore in France for Operation Overlord, the invasion of German-occupied Europe, Bill Harrison, a joiner in Civvy Street, was with them. First, though, we'll hear the remarkable Hector Duff's memories of coming ashore through the hail of bullets and shells.
Every vehicle that was coming ashore didn't get ashore. The beach was littered with men that had been shot. Oh, it was a terrible sight, you'll never forget.
There were literally hundreds of bodies floating about as we were landing. And the old brigadier that was with me, he said, well, we're back in the war again now. The ramp went down and we went off and the tide was out. We had a long drive to get up through the beach, and we were met with an awful lot of shelling. You didn't have time to stop and think there about your danger.
Most of the bodies that we seen were ships that had been hauled or shelled, yeah, and sunk, and the bodies of the soldiers with their equipment on drowned, right. And they were then they were floating in the water. Yeah. And my first thing when I came off the craft, made our way up to a hedgerow to get cover, and there was a great heap alongside us, about six of us there, and I remember the blankets, and we just lifted the blanket, and there was some of the dead infantry covered over. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So we then were checking up for mines on the beaches, till the next day when our barges had come over by the tugs, and for 2 weeks we did beach work, such as using these barges to ferry out prisoners to the supply ships and bring back ammunition and rations and various other equipment.
Where did you sleep overnight?
On the ground. Well, we dug in, actually, in a field just the other side of the road. Mm. We always... I never seen a bed till later on in the campaign at a place called Blerick.
Yeah.
But what we used to do was two men, we'd dig a trench about 2 feet deep and put the ground sheets on it, and you'd get a couple of hours sleep and then on duty for 4 hours and so on. Mm. And if it was wet, you use your gas capes to cover you over.
You wouldn't be under fire, though, in any case at this time, would you?
Well, there was shell fire,
yeah,
but that was more or less in the distance.
Yes. Hmm. Then you, at this stage, probably didn't know what the objective was or where you were going anyway, would you?
Well, through the grapevine, the main point was to try and take Caen in the first day.
Mm.
But Montgomery, in that section, was in command, and the Americans landed over on the west, and they did a detour while the British and the Canadians took all the flak on our area, and Caen was not taken till the end of July.
Yeah. When did you move away from the beaches, and what was your next move?
Well, our next move was, our companies were specially for large Bailey pontoon bridge and also the assault crossing for the main rivers. And the main rivers, the first one was the Seine. The next one was Nijmegen with the Operation Market Garden for Arnhem. And the next one after that was at Venlo. And the next, the largest bridge, was on the Rhine at Exanten across to Wesel.
Manxman Bill Harrison in Europe as the Allies pushed the German army back. But that was almost 80 years ago. Many seemed to come through the experience intact, but most also bore mental scars as well as the physical memories they were unable or unwilling to describe for years with their families, some ever. But those families were conscious of the war baggage they returned with. Jill Skinner, and first, Stacey Astle.
I'm Stacey Astle, and this is my grandfather, Alan Platts Barrett. Alan was a prisoner of war during the Second World War. He fought as part of the 129th Regiment and was captured during the fall of Crete, and then was in captivity all the way from 1941 to the end of the war. He was repatriated, so this was a process which involved them being taken to an airbase and then flown home, although they weren't particularly equipped to take the Manx prisoners home, so he got taken to the UK, and at that point he found a fishing boat and hitched a ride home to the island. Granda didn't particularly like to talk about the bad parts of the story. We did know that he was a prisoner of war, but obviously he was trying to look after us, so would only really tell us the funny things. So we got a lot of stories about when they were learning German from the guards, and one of the guys decided to ask the Germans what time it was and asked fish paste, but they managed to respond because they vaguely understood that he meant Wiesbaden. However, we didn't really learn about the more harrowing details until later on when I began studying the topic. During the war, there was a lot of starvation for the prisoners of war, especially in the winter of 1942. There was a particularly bad period where a lot of men suffered horrifying hunger. By the end of the war, every single member of the Manx regiment that was captured, the 129th, had experienced issues with their stomachs. And for a while after the war, he was only able to eat things like mashed potatoes with milk because that was all his stomach could take. He also lost his eye during the conflict as well. I think it definitely stayed with him. He was very sure to talk about how important it was that war didn't happen again on that scale, or ever, really. He often referred to Remembrance Day as Denkmal, which was a term he learned from some of the guards in the camps that he had interactions with, and he referred to that as thinking time, so it was time to reflect and ensure that it never occurred again. I don't think anyone could go through an experience like that and not be impacted by it. And it did affect him in a lot of ways, even things like throwing away food. He would never waste food. So we used to have to occasionally hide things and take them into different bins because he would go and get it out of his own bin if he threw away something mouldy. So we used to use the cafe across the road just to make sure that he wasn't poisoning himself because he was so certain that it was wasteful to throw things away. It actually began as a side project during my history masters. I decided that I wanted to do a conference paper about the Manx prisoners of war because I couldn't find a huge amount of information on them. And obviously there was this story about something that was so personal to me, but also so relevant to the island because all but 31 men from the regiment were captured on Crete. So this was a huge chunk of our population or our fighting population that had gone. So I wanted to find out more. So when I started studying it, I just realised that was what I wanted to do, that was what I wanted to learn about, because the prisoner of war experience was just so interesting. There's obviously a lot known about the Great Escape, but there's not so much about the experience of the men in the camps, and often the Great Escape and things like that are thought off of these massive forms of resistance, but actually there was so much resistance going on within the camps. So I actually ended up doing my master's dissertation on that instead of what I originally planned, and then went on to do my PhD about the experience of prisoners of war as well. It was very difficult, especially because Grander, although he wouldn't talk about it to us when we were younger and didn't really talk to me about it until I was studying it, because he thought it was important for me to know, did then tell me a lot more about the experience. So it was difficult to hear some of it and difficult to comprehend some of the things that all of these men went through. And I think that's why it's important to remember prisoners of war as well on Remembrance Day, because although it's not an experience we often hear about when we talk about conflicts, it was extremely significant and difficult. He was fantastic. He used to have a workshop near our house, and because of the experience in the camps, he never ever felt hunger again. So we regularly had to go down and check on him. So I'd often go down when I was younger and stop him from doing whatever he was doing and try and drag him home to at least have a little bit of bread and jam. He was fantastic for just teaching us lots of different interesting things, and we always had a wonderful time with him. He was always making things. He actually learnt joinery in the camps because he was forced to work. And luckily for him, he ended up with some very nice civilian guards who were teaching him how to do woodworking. So he learned some fantastic skills while he was there. It wasn't all a negative experience. So I think a lot of that carried through and shaped his life as well. Remembrance is such a difficult topic now because it's become so strangely co-opted and polarised. I think the most important thing is remembering everyone who was impacted by conflict, everyone who has been impacted by conflict, but not glorifying it. That's not what this is about. It's about remembering what happened and making sure that it does not happen again.
My mother's father, William Billy Jones, was born in 1898 in Leeds. When the First World War broke out, he lied about his age and joined up, basically. Looking back at photographs of him, he was a boy. However, as we all know, that at that time, they didn't necessarily differentiate or discourage the maybe patriotic fervour that there was, the promise that everything would be over by Christmas, the excitement. He was from a very poor part of Leeds and a very sort of challenged background. And I think this was an opportunity for him. And he saw it as doing the right thing. He was, we know from his records, that he was shot in the early part of the First World War, and then spent 2 years in an unnamed military hospital in London rehabilitating. He was shot in his leg. I understand that there was parts of his uniform in the wounds in his legs right up until my grandfather died. But they patched him up, and after 2 years they sent him back out, and we know this time this was to Passchendaele, where he was gassed. I don't know whether it was mustard gas or chlorine gas, but we know that he was understandably very poorly afterwards, and that ill health dogged him all of his life, and he actually died in 1953, so he was still in his 50s when he died. And my grandmother, my granny, always said that she felt she was a war widow. By that time, my mother's family were living in Hounslow in West London. My grandfather was an engineer working on developing Heathrow Airport. And my eldest aunt married a Manxman, a man from Andreas called Herbert Nettleton. And during the Second World War, my aunt married my uncle Herbert. And when my grandparents came over here to visit her, because she moved over with her husband to the island, it was during the Second World War they came over to visit. And my granddad apparently found he could breathe better. And somehow they took a huge leap of faith and bought a small holding, Dreamscary Farm, up in Mackled. And he worked on that and farmed it until his death in 1953. The ongoing health issues included he had several heart attacks. He always had problems with his breathing. And his legs still gave him issues from the being shot as a teenager.
What does it mean to you, knowing now what you do about your grandfather, William Billy Jones?
That he must have been an incredibly resilient and optimistic young man to go through all of that. And then he met and married my granny, my grandmother, and they had six children. Four of them lived. They lost the first child and then the fourth child. But despite that, he never gave up, and he was a tough, perhaps a bluff Yorkshireman, but he was a strong character. And we do feel, we laugh in the family about the Jones genes, and that we are all quite sort of feisty. That old question, as I said to you, Beth, if I could invite anybody round for dinner, living or dead, it would always be my granddad.
What does remembrance mean to you now that you know a little of his story?
It's recognising and remembering and giving consideration to those who believed they did the right thing for all of us. And I believe that even the military, the more recent conflicts, I think there is a great belief amongst those young men and women that they left wherever, whether it was Bosnia or Iraq or Afghan, that they did a good job and left it a better place. And I think we need to support that, but not to turn them into victims.
Jill Skinner and Stacey Astle. We watched the Gulf War on TV. We saw the air attacks, the missile attacks, the troops going forward. But what was the effect for those on the front line and in the air? Chris Charlie Brown is president of the Isle of Man's Royal Air Force Association. His squadron of Tornadoes was stationed there. He says the experience created a them and us split as a result.
I went out to launch an aeroplane. An order came through. It's on hold. Just stand down. Keep the aircraft powered up, but the crew aren't coming out just yet. And then that turned into another hour. And then it turned into switch the power off and come back in, but make sure you can get it ready to go again in very short notice. And then it came to kind of stand down. We realised there was some form of ceasefire going on, and that mission never went. You know, it was the one that didn't go, and we were so happy with that. When the order came through that's it's a ceasefire, we all wanted to go back to. Well, our homes were in Germany, which is where we were based, and we just wanted a beer. And then it was hurry up and wait to go back. You know, we were quite low priority. When you're high priority to get out to something, it's a different world when you have to come back. I went home. I went back to Germany, and then I went home to see my parents, who were quite elderly. They'd both lived through the Blitz, as young people, you know, during World War II, and they were kind of concerned on how I'd be, and I was fine with most things. I didn't like during the air attacks. We had a bell for our to warn us of enemy missile attacks, and I didn't like telephone bells. You know, that shook me at the time, because that usually preceded an explosion. It was a feeling of, when we got back to the squadron in Germany, nothing was ever the same again. And the guys, we had to be very careful not to alienate the guys on the unit who hadn't been out to the Gulf, because there was suddenly a huge us and them. There was, you know, those who'd done it and those who hadn't done it. And it was, our boss was very adamant that we didn't isolate people when we got back. But for the first, well, for years, and it would be years after returning from the Gulf, nothing really seemed to matter. You didn't worry about trivial things with work anymore, because you thought, yeah, we've done the job for real. It's quite difficult to explain. The bond between the people who were there is amazing. COVID I had a few very major operations last year, and I missed the reunion before COVID hit. So then I missed the squadron reunion for COVID. And it's just so important to be with those people who you shared those experiences with. You'll have heard of Gulf War Syndrome, which the UK government refuses to accept exists. And it's not one particular illness. It's many different illnesses and that can't be fully explained. But they're so random that they just refuse to accept that it's related to service in the Gulf. I suffer from very, very bad tinnitus, you know, ringing in my ears, and it's there absolutely all the time. It ranges from bad to absolutely unbearable. I've had other complications, but I couldn't put them down to Gulf service. I mean, I've fixed aeroplanes for 40 odd years, and you know, your knees tend to get hammered with things like that. It's but maybe the neurological stuff. Remembrance is a very personal thing, and certainly Remembrance Day is every day for some people. You know, we always go through that. It's just a public. It's a public showing of it. I would say that's probably the big thing to me. People remember, you know, World War One. My grandfather, he was gassed in April 1918. He didn't die until I was about four when he died. He was blinded, but well, if he had not lived, I wouldn't be here, because my mum wasn't born until 1925. But I know for a fact that my granddad never wore his medals. He never took them out the boxes. He never spoke about what happened. That's from you know, my mother and father. It's different, you know. That was such a different war to mine.
Today there will be many, many words of remembrance. Most people, not touched by war, will regard today's events from a distance. Perhaps some even as an interruption to their normal lives. But for others, it will be perhaps the silences that touch most deeply, for those who either personally or through a member of their family still experience the aftermath of war. The guns may be silent, but those memories stay to haunt.
Then they beat the drum slowly, then they play the fife. They sung the death march as they lowered you down. Did the band play the last Boston chorus? Did the pipes play the flowers of the fall?